today with an outstanding panel of people we've gathered here today. We've touched on some of these issues a little bit of affordability strategies that students can take to help them address the high cost of higher education, but we're going to dive into that a little bit deeper with the great group that we have here. To my far right, we have Patty Hanser, who's the director of the Office of Career and Technical Education in the Michigan Department of Education. We have Sherry Waglander, who's the director of Middle and Early College in the Michigan College Association. We have Jim Bardick, who is WE Uptown Institute's senior economist there. We have Dan Hurley, the chief executive officer of the Michigan Association of State Universities, and Mike Hansen, who is the president of the Michigan Community College Association. So as we've heard today, Michigan residents firmly believe that college or some other advanced training is essential to succeed in today's economy. At the same time, however, rising tuition and concerns over student debt make these options feel out of reach. So in this panel, we're going to talk about some of these alternative strategies. I'm going to start with Mike. Mike, can you tell us how community college fits into this future and some of the things we can do to enhance this option even more?
Yes, thank you, Jeff, and thanks for the center for having us here today. I think in the morning we've heard a lot of ideas and maybe theoretical approaches. It's an interesting way to close this session, I think, with some real-life examples of things that are actually going on to improve efficiencies and improve outcomes for students. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, I think any conversation in higher education that talks about access and affordability at that intersection are the 28 public community colleges. Many students attend a community college because of those issues, because of access, geographic access, and affordability. So the question becomes, how do we really leverage this incredible infrastructure, the 28 public community colleges in Michigan, how do we leverage that resource as a way to make this more efficient? So one of the ways we've done that is 3 years ago, the legislature created a committee to look at the transferability issue. How do we make it more efficient for students that have community college credits to transfer to the university? And out of that study group came something called the Michigan Transfer Agreement, which exists today. That will ensure that the 30 credits, the general education core, what we call the Michigan Transfer Agreement, if you have a class at a community college in that Michigan Transfer Agreement, those 30 credits will transfer without question to any public university in this state. That is a way to immediately create guaranteed efficiency, predictability, and affordability for community colleges. But we always saw that as the first step. The first step was the first 30 credits. Ultimately, what we'd like to do is get at, which other states have done, is that if you have an associate's degree from any public community college, that degree should transfer as a block of credits to the university where you start as a junior. They're not electives, they're part of the degree, so that you have 60 credits left to finish. Other states have figured this out, so this year the legislature has created another committee to look at this issue, to look at the opportunities and the challenges to creating a system where the block of 60 credits earned in an associate's degree will transfer to any public university and students start as a junior. That immediately creates efficiency, that immediately increases affordability to access to a community college degree. So I should also point out that sometimes this is seen as sort of an us versus them. These are hard things to work through, and these result in partnerships, and tomorrow, for example, is the first meeting of this 60-credit block, which is made up of university representatives, community college representatives, legislative representatives, all sitting together working things out. There's a will to get this done. It's just hard work, and it's going to take some time and effort, but community colleges are certainly willing to step up and do that. But let me just say one other thing, and it was mentioned by John Austin, this notion of a guided pathway for community college students. So having the seamless transfer to the four-year degree is part of the equation, but the other part of the equation is we have to be better in the community college system of actually creating pathways for students. So it is no longer acceptable for us to simply hand an incoming student a course catalog and say, go have fun, explore yourself, find yourself. We have to make sure that the student has better counseling, better pathways, knows their choices, so that the random selection of courses they take actually results in some kind of path toward a transfer that then transfers to that university. So it's sort of a both and. We have to do a better job providing those pathways for students, but then they have to lead to a transfer to create the most efficiency for the student.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. Sherry, we've heard some mention today of early and middle college. Can you tell us about early and middle college and what the benefits are for students who participate?
First of all, I want to ask, how many of you here are actively involved in your communities with a middle or early college program? Look at that. You look just like the map of Michigan that we have now. That just tickles the daylights out of me. I remember 25 years ago, as it were yesterday, opening Mott Middle College on the campus of Mott Community College. We didn't even have the phrase early college yet. It was built on the back of the middle college program that started in 1974 at LaGuardia in New York. The state of that situation today is that we have 23 wall-to-wall, fully recognized by the Michigan Department of Ed, middle and early college schools in dynamic relationships and partnerships with their higher education partners. We have 67 subpopulation district middle early colleges approved by the state. And we have 11 enhanced dual enrollment system districts that are in a pilot program that I'm directing, where we're trying to increase the number of students who leave doing better in high school STEM related coursework and choosing STEM related careers as their selected path there. The key to the four models that we have in Michigan is that they are all planned educational models. Students have wraparound services that help them commit to a 5-year pathway. Because I've been in this for 25 years, I wanted to just share a couple of statistics that I bulleted six important outcomes that I think you need to be very proud of. In our longitudinal study of our 11 Davis schools over the last 6 years, we are based on 3,564 of our more than 6,000 early middle college students in Michigan. They are graduating with an average of 51.6 college credits, with a college GPA of 3.09, with a 91% C or higher pass rate. That's phenomenal. How does that save money? It saves money, of course, for the family, that this is out of the FTE and it's out of the collaboration. More importantly for me, it hits in that developmental ed bucket that we have that's so full in our state and across the nation. Middle early college students do not do a role in developmental ed courses. We had to learn how to do our work differently, and by the we, as a K-12 person, we, all of our schools, had come up with a counter and say, what are we not doing to have our students ready to start credit-bearing courses and do a role with our partners in higher education? So that is a huge savings to our system and our state as a whole. Other savings have to do with students being truly ready to be successful moving on and finishing their associate or going on to a 4-year master's doctorate degree. We did quantitative and qualitative research. In the qualitative research, 97% of the graduates in those programs perceive themselves as ready to be in college, can view themselves in college, and feel that they are going to be very comfortable going on for higher degrees. What I think is important to note is that the gap and the separation between K-12 and higher ed was so much deeper than I ever realized 25 years ago. And I think that is the gift of the middle early college program, especially in our state, because we're right out of the lead on this movement nationally, has given. And that is that we have shown that when you break down those barriers and you jointly take responsibility and view every one of our students as higher education bound, whether it's a CTE program, STEM program, a liberal arts program, work changes among our educators, and it changes from the college perspective, and it changes from the curriculum perspective. And I'll stop there for a
Great. Patty, I want to turn to you, ask if you have any additional thoughts on early and middle college, but also if you could tell us how career and technical education programs fit into the picture.
Happy to. It's my pleasure to be here with all of you today. There are a couple of other things I wanted to mention about early middle colleges. They're different than dual enrollment in that these are actual high schools. The students stay on for an additional or a fifth year. So they graduate at the end of 5 years with both a high school diploma and some substantial college credit. So that makes them different than dual enrollment, and they're very purposeful as well. The other part I wanted to mention is that you heard Jerry say that there are 90 early middle colleges. We had just two for 20 years, but now we have 90. And I think probably 19 of those are programs that are coordinated by an ISD, an intermediate school district. And what that means is that all of the high schools within that intermediate school district and all of those school districts are eligible to participate. So we ran some numbers of all the high schools in Michigan and the high schools that have an early middle college opportunity available for their students, and it's 64% of high schools have this option available to students. That's huge. But it also means that there's a lot of technical assistance that we need to do through Cherry and through my office. But I do want to address career and technical education, which is actually where I come from, and you might wonder why someone in career and technical education got into this early middle college thing. But back in 2006, then Governor Granholm wanted to expand early middle colleges, and particularly in healthcare fields, because there was predicted to be a shortage in that area. So because it was healthcare and an instructional program that is specific to career and technical education, that's how I came to work with Cherry Wagenlander in 2006, and it's been quite a ride. But CTE does offer lots of opportunities for post-secondary and college success for students in these ways. First of all, our instructional programs at the high school level are required to be aligned with the corresponding community college program. Our administrators and our teachers work very closely with the 28 community colleges that Mike is in charge of. And it's a very labor-intensive thing. You sit down faculty to faculty to talk about what's being taught. Those silos that Cherry was talking about have to break down so that we can make sure to have that seamless transfer from the high school program to the community college program. So that alignment also helps the student not to waste time, not to duplicate instruction that they might be getting in both places. And in some cases, there is articulated credit that's held in escrow. For example, the community college faculty member will say, well, that is content that I teach in my intro at the community college. So if you're teaching that at the high school, when your student gets here, we'll either waive that course or give them credit for that course. So that also helps to make that seamless transition. Other ways that CTE helps with post-secondary success is that students have that pathway that Mike mentioned. They have an idea of what career they want and how to get there. Even if they start down healthcare and once they get to their clinicals decide they don't like blood, I still think of that as being a success because that's helped that student to make that decision of where to go. Students also get work-based learning in our programs and opportunities for student leadership, which are huge. It's one of the places in these areas that they learn those work behavior skills and learn information about careers. These are also very strong students. They take not only all the academics required of the Michigan Merit Curriculum, but also a very rigorous program in career tech ed. Our placement rates, just a little black bragging, are 95%. 95% of our students either get a job or go into college once they leave our programs. And about 67% of them go on to college. So these are some pretty strong students that actually have a direction.
Great, thank you very much. Tim, I want to turn to you. We know that Kalamazoo has got something special going on with the Kalamazoo Promise, and we know you've done some research on this. And so wondering if you can share with us what your research on the Promise has demonstrated with respect to the potential of this type of program.
Thank you, Jeff. I guess I shouldn't assume at the outset that everyone here is as familiar as people at Kalamazoo certainly are with the details of the Kalamazoo Promise, but just to remind you of what that is, it's a privately funded college scholarship program started in 2005. It basically is extremely simple, extremely generous, extremely universal. No high school graduate GPA requirements. All you have to do is have attended Kalamazoo School since ninth grade, live in the district, And you automatically get, at that point, 65% of tuition if you start in the ninth grade, and you get up to 100% if you started in kindergarten in public schools at any Michigan public university or community college. And then the last year, they've added some private Michigan colleges. So it's distinguished by being very simple. It is literally a one-page form you fill out. The form asks you, do you live in the Kalamazoo School District? How long have you been attending the schools? And where are you going to college? That's it. It is not like the FAFSA in the least. And we looked at what, and the number of communities around the country are imitating this. We're having a conference next week. Promise that there are at least 30 or 40 imitation programs. Some of them taxpayer finance, not privately financed. So that is an option. What have been the impacts of the Kalamazoo Promise? It's increased enrollment in Kalamazoo public schools by over 25%. About one quarter of this is from students outside of Michigan. The rest is from within the state. It's stabilized the racial integration of KPS. It's attracted black students, Hispanic students, Asian students, white students in roughly equal proportion. So it's stabilized racial integration. I think that's valuable, and hopefully other people do too. It's led to reduced student suspension rates in high school. We estimate it's increased the GPA of African American students by 0.7 points on a 4-point scale. That's big. Test scores have increased in KPS relative to the comparison districts, although some of that's due to things other than the promise. We estimate that the promise, as of 6 years after high school graduation, has increased post-secondary credential attainment rates by one-third. Most of that is due to increased bachelor attainment, which has also gone up by one-third. If you do a benefit-cost analysis of the promise, you get the result, based on the effects on educational attainment and what you would predict for what that means for future earnings, that for every dollar invested in promise scholarships, the present value of future earnings goes up by about $5. To put it another way, if the promise was a stock market investment, it has a real rate of return after inflation of about 11%. So if you can get that in the stock market, please let me know who your stockbroker is and how I can invest with him or her. It also changed the mix of enrollment. Students became much more likely to enroll in promise-eligible schools. And we found the number enrolling in non-promise-eligible schools actually dropped by two-thirds. Almost all that is due to not enrolling in non-Michigan schools. More students are enrolling in Michigan schools. There's also some evidence that promise programs increase property values in population. Studies of promise programs suggest that in the promise area itself, property values go up between 6 and 12%. For the overall metropolitan area, and remember, only a small portion of the metro area for most promise programs is actually eligible for the promise. It looks like for the average promise program around the country, metro area population goes up about 2% overall, and property values maybe 1.5%. So it attracts people. You have to remember, in terms of attracting people, about 40% of the population of the U.S. is in households that have kids under 18. So this is a very attractive program. Now, one thing I'd like to address is the promise scalable. Well, the promise is very simple. The only problem in scaling it up is money. Promise costs about $20,000 per high school graduate. That's the total cost of it. When you look for how, of course, some students obviously it's more because they go to the University of Michigan, go there for 4 years. Other students it's much less because they go for one semester somewhere and whatever. That's the average cost, $20,000. So Michigan has about a little over 100,000 high school graduates, so the cost for programs statewide, if you just said, okay, we're going to have a Michigan promise, do exactly like Kalamazoo or publicly funded, cost is about $2 billion a year. Now, probably that's roughly feasible. I'm not in the business of assessing political feasibility. I'm an economist. I just want to point out that from an economic point of view, you get 5 times that in benefits. You would get a considerable increase in Michigan population, 2 to 6% in Michigan population probably, would be my guess. at least 2%, maybe 6% increase in the state's population. You probably would get an increase in earnings even if people without. I mean, basically, one question you have to ask is, why on earth are we subsidizing higher education anyway? Well, the reason we're doing it is we think there are spillover benefits, that everyone benefits. If my neighbor, why should I invest in other people's kids? Because if other people's kids get more skills, it benefits me directly. It benefits me because a more skilled economy produces higher wages for everyone. So, basically, based on reasonable estimates of how many promise graduates would stay in Michigan, you probably get about a 4-to-1, for every dollar you put in the program, in the long run, earnings would go up by about $4. But, maybe that's not feasible. We don't want to invest in things that have a high benefit-cost ratio. You could think about reducing costs. The key issue is it risks undermining why the promise works, which is that it's universal, it's generous, and it's simple. If I had to choose, I would choose on reducing generosity first, followed by universality, and then the last thing I'd give up is the simplicity. So you could talk about reducing generosity by reducing the percentage of tuition subsidized. Kalamazoo subsidizes 65 to 100%. You can cut that back. You could cut it from 4 years of college to 2. You could do universality if you had a very, very simple sliding scale based on income. But it's got to be simple. If it's anything like the FAFSA, forget it. You have to make it simple. If you want to change people's behavior, you have to make them an offer they can understand. Complicated systems that people like me, economists, set up that have very complicated incentive structures do not work in the real world. People are not math majors who can figure out the very complicated set of incentives that we like to set up that have just the right optimal setup, but no one can figure them out. So whatever we do, I think we need to try to be err on the side of making things very, very simple. But the key point is, costs are an obstacle to economic progress by reducing access to education. It is not simply a matter of the quality of K-12 system or the quality of student preparation. If you make college free, you increase college attainment by a third. That's what the Kalamazoo Promise experience shows. Thanks.
Thanks, Tim. Dan, we heard this a couple times today, particularly with four-year universities, that many middle-class families are concerned that the cost of a four-year university puts it out of reach for their family, or that they have small children, that the cost is going to be out of reach by the time their kids get to be college age. How real a problem is this for middle-class families? Are they priced out of the market? And what strategies can these families use to try to make college an affordable experience?
Now, there's a mistake. There's a chatter that all the two four-year schools don't collaborate on. So here you have an ironic word, sharing sound. There certainly has been a lot of focus. It's interesting the framework of today's discussion. Certainly been a lot of focus on state side, state policy, state investment, even more so on institutional policy. A lot of data points throughout the day. There's been a lot of disinvestment. In inflation adjusted, there's been a $1 billion disinvestment in state higher ed since 2002. I think the most fascinating stat, though, is that in the same time frame, the public 4 years in the state, the universities and add up their state approaches and their tuition prices. Today, inflation adjusted, they're spending $800 less per full-time resident undergraduate. $800 less. Okay? One macro data point to talk about is the tremendous amount of efficiency taking place. One thing, certainly a lot of advice that could be provided to parents, students, and really the toughest challenge is that middle income bracket, lower middle income. One thing I've heard a whole lot about today is the state prepaid or 529 savings plans. We had officials here running the program here, and those are significant vehicles for tax savings. So certainly, if you haven't done that as a parent, it's a good thing to do is start really planting that seed. Certainly, it's a very good idea to have a good idea, and this is not an easy task all the time, but really, what are the true costs involved? And while I certainly transparency is an issue, the figures are out there. And the only thing we said one time today from Rachel Fishman that one of the there's this discussion is remarkably important to have. I think the power in the center for putting forth this conversation. But there is a across all public surveys an overestimation of what college costs when you factor in all of the institutional aid, state aid, federal aid, significant overestimation. And I think we need to, as a society, as a state, as policymakers, as parents, we need to have a better grasp of really what the actual dollars are. And I guess in looking at, since a lot of focus is on institutional, when I look at all of the practices out there, one just nationally that's been a lot of focus on, certainly increasing student retention. We've heard a lot of things about the work you can have is someone who spends a lot on tuition and doesn't graduate, so making sure those students stay in college and then go full-time. There's a lot of focus, certainly at the federal level and at the institutional level, more innovative policies around course scheduling, tuition discounts, as I mentioned here. If you can get students to get 15 credits per semester, get them out the door in 4 years, they have a huge leg up. And also around efficiency is trying to target students. There is a student role here, just one time. There's a big student accountability role here, and that is take the 120 credits required. Is it okay to change majors? Yes, and there may be a couple of extra credits accounted for there. But it is a little bit alarming when you look at the average credit load taken by the average college degree recipient in this country. And not all that needs to be placed on the shoulders of the universities or the college. And so to get out in as few credits as it is possible and to go about that efficiently. The last thing I would say, again, a lot of the focal areas, as was mentioned earlier today, I think a lot more can be done. Certainly, probably at community colleges and public comprehensive universities, it's working on that issue of remedial education, developmental education, a huge amount of waste and inefficiency by a lot of the students and certainly taxpayer dollars in that regard, is to fold in so those remedial and developmental courses are credit bearing. And a lot of innovation going on in the area. If we can make some improvements in that area, I think we'll move the dial in terms of improving the retention and college going and getting out the door at the time of manner for a good swath of students from lower middle income families.
Thank you. So this next question is for Mike, you, Patty, Sherry also. A lot of these programs we've talked about have a lot of variability depending on where you live. So not everybody lives in a community college district. Not everybody has the same career technical education opportunities available to them depending on what school or ISD they're in, or live in a school with a middle college opportunity. So how much of an issue is this in the state, and what should we be doing about it?
Exactly what we've been working on is scaling up middle and early college opportunities across the state of Michigan. And we're working on blended delivery opportunities because we know we have pockets of areas that are very rural. And I am passionate about equity and access. So that as you see this spread across the state, it's because of the collaboration that we're now working with and up with all of our community colleges and 8 of our 4-year institutions and others are ready to come on board. And we've passed the tipping point. We have to solve this delivery system and working with NASA and working with understanding that students can learn differently than these bright-eyed campus. Is that the best?
experience for students to have? Absolutely. To leave high school knowing that they have been in a few classes with fixed ages on a college campus with a real college instructor. But in order to scale the up across our state, we have to look at varying the model and varying the delivery method with the higher
Well, we do have expansion issues in those areas. You're right. Community college districts that don't reach everyone. Career and technical education programs that are, in their defense, they're expensive for school districts to run, more expensive than the regular academics. And so sometimes it's not feasible for a district to operate a program. But we're also looking at creative ways to deliver that. Online instruction, I think, has a lot of potential for us. And, you know, we'd like to see some of these things addressed. There was $10 million put in the state school aid budget this year to help try to address some of these things. And the funding is intended to be used for early middle colleges that focus on career and technical education programs, particularly where there might be one that's lacking and where there is a gap in available people to fill jobs. So that's one attempt to try to address some of this inequity across the state, but it is a real issue. Right now, we're working with a company, a contractor, to do a study of what does the career readiness system look like in Michigan. So they're going to be looking at where there are community college programs, where are there high school programs, and where are there gaps, and making some recommendations on what we can do policy-wise and strategically in order to help remedy some of that.
Okay, just quickly, the community college districts cover about 50% of the state's geography, but about 80% of the state's population. So about 80% of the population lives within a community college district. In those areas that aren't part of a community college district, many of our colleges have centers. So these are actual buildings, locations outside of their district that are somewhat comprehensive, meaning not only can you get classes there, but you can get counseling, financial aid, advising, career placement, those kind of things. But even in those areas where we don't have a center and you're not in the district, many of our colleges will actually send faculty out to the high schools or out to the community to provide classes in the community and in the high school. And many of our community colleges are also using this model that was talked about earlier that we call concurrent enrollment or direct credit, where we're actually utilizing the high school faculty, if they're properly credentialed, to provide the college course at the high school during the high school day to high school students. That's maybe the most efficient use of providing a community college service right at the high school. But the final thing I'd like to mention is that, you know, we have really put a lot of money into developing our online programs at community colleges. And with the state's assistance a couple of years ago of $1 million grant to really revitalize all of our online learning opportunities at community colleges called Michigan Colleges Online, so that if you're a student at Lansing Community College and you need an accounting class, you can take that class from any of the 28 community colleges, and that gets transcripted. You register at your local college, it gets transcripted at your local college. So for the student, that's seamless. They're just happen to be taking accounting from Kellogg Community College. But if you're at Lansing, you think it's from Lansing Community College. There's no reason that can't also be offered to high school students. And we've been working with many of our high school partners to allow that online experience that high school students now must have. Why don't they also use that to get college credit through Michigan Colleges Online at the same time? So I think there's lots of ways that we can leverage some of the systems that are currently out there.
No, I'm coming close to the end of our appointed time here. Do we have enough time for a couple questions from the audience?
I think so. The very first question here is, one audience member said that a population that hasn't been discussed today includes undocumented teens and teens who have deferred action for childhood arrivals. Many of these teens want to go on to have a post-secondary credential but are not eligible for federal aid, loans, or in-state tuition rates at Michigan schools. Considering our own limited resources, how can we best support this population, and how can we include them in this conversation?
I'll say a few words. That certainly has been a discussion item nationally over the last many years. I will say, coast to coast, there has certainly been an orientation towards more access, primarily through the provision of in-state tuition rates. I don't know, I can say about the public four-year university is there they certainly respond to that practice of having a pro-access orientation with some nuances what they have by how they go about determining that. But that is key. There's some debate. It's mostly, I think, in the southern states. I don't think it's as big of an issue here in Michigan. But I think that any society needs to promote educational access for anyone who seeks to further their education to contribute to the economy.
All right. This next question is for Patty and Jerry. Is there data on retention and graduation from four-year schools in regards to early and middle college enrolled students versus those who didn't go through early and middle college? Examples might be time to degree, credits needed, et cetera.
I think I'm not dodging the question, but I think we're still pretty early in the process to collect really good data on all of these schools. Because they've been growing, and remember when they start, it's going to take a student 3 years to get through that high school program if they start, for example, in 11th grade. So we've got multiple years before we can actually see how they did once they left these early middle colleges. But Cherry does have a data study that she's doing with school.
I smile because we're so excited about an extended data analysis, collection analysis and application project that we have in collaboration with NCREST, which is a research unit of Teachers College, which is part of Columbia University in New York. And they have been following 11 of our lab schools for 5 years, the 9th through 13th year. And in collaboration with Michigan through the CEPI office, we're going to be carefully with very clean data, not only using what we can pull down from the clearinghouse data, but very precise, clean data for our Michigan students to see what are their completion rates. I can tell you qualitatively, just for my middle early college, which was my baby for all those years, that we know that we are having a lot of completers. Not only are we having completers, but for 5 years we've been asking our graduates, do you envision yourself finishing an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a doctorate degree? Now these are students who didn't even know that there were degrees, okay? And every year we watch that percentage go up until the last year 20% perceive themselves as going on master's degree or doctorate degree level, 65% finishing a four-year degree, and like 90% finishing an associate. So we're trying, and we know we need clean data, and we know it's hard to get because of mobility and following all the higher ed, but I'm smiling because I'm so excited that we finally have the agreement, we have the plan, we have an outside group that's going to be helping us track that. Fantastic. Looks like I think we have time for maybe one more question. I'm just looking here at one that perhaps all of us can take a crack at here. This question asks, and this seems like it might be an opinion question, what is the appropriate percentage at a university between supporting athletics and academics?
Depends how the football game's played.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly, I mean, there's a lot of discussion in that, and that varies so much from the type of institution. And there is
the expense of NCAA.
How does the institution go out to work? But that is an excellent, it's robust athletics, and it's a main attraction for a student body, for especially a state that's blessed with some rather globally branded universities that have athletic departments. I think that lifts all boats. And certainly there is some, there's probably significant, there is about significant dollars to go from those programs that benefit the students. So it's going to vary by institution, a lot of focus on that. But I think that institutional leaders are going about from a due diligence standpoint to make sure that they're spending the appropriate amount on the academic core. And I think that's ultimately what the discussion will be. And I will say, nationally, speaking for the public universities, that brand of quality higher education is very high. I think we need to not lose sight of that over, you know, coaches' salaries or whatever.
Before I close, Sherry, you wanted to...
You get to be my rage, and you're not only an actual grandma, but a grandma to a movement. I just want to take an opportunity to thank all of you as policymakers for convening today and seriously taking it under your responsibility to figure out how you're going to finance higher education to a higher degree in our state. We took the choice away from our students with this movement about whether they would go on for more training beyond high school. That's the secret. That's the simplicity. That's what works. That's how far we push the envelope in our state. The State Board of Education expects all of our graduates to have had a successful higher education experience before they leave high school. And it makes a huge difference. So our young people are expecting to go on beyond K-12. So it's imperative that we do solve these questions and move this work forward. I'm so appreciative of Mike Hansen, so many guardian angels the last 25 years in our state. Patty Cantu, our both governors, everybody has worked so hard, and it's so important in the role that we're playing nationally. This is a college high school educational reform movement for Congress. So I just want to take a risk, take 4 minutes of your time, and say a big thank you.
Thank you. And before I throw it back to Haley and Phil, I just want to thank our panelists today. I thought this was an outstanding panel. Patty, Sherry, Tim, Dan, and Mike, thank you very much.